Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got plenty in store for you on this week's show. We'll be previewing the start of England's series in India. We'll be reacting to all the cricket that's been going on around the world. And we've got a special interview between Joe and Owen Morgan later in the show that is well worth a listen. I'm Yaz Rana, and to discuss all that and much more on this very gloomy Wednesday morning, I'm joined by the Wisden Cricket Monthly trio of Phil Walker, Joe Harmon and Jim Wallace. Still no Harry Kane, folks, so if any of our listeners has an in with Harry, do let us know. The biggest and most exciting piece of news this week, at least from an English perspective, was the news that Channel 4 are set to broadcast the India-England series in the UK. For non-UK-based listeners, Channel 4 is a free-to-air broadcaster. You don't need a subscription for it. And if the series is shown on Channel 4, it'll be the first time since the 2005 Ashes that English Test cricket will be shown live on free-to-air TV in the UK. Although I must stress that with less than 48 hours to go until the start of the series, nothing has actually been confirmed yet, although The Guardian are reporting that everything is signed, sealed and sorted. Phil, obviously this is amazing news. It's not quite the same as a thrilling World Cup final that goes to Super Over, but the potential this series could have as the country's in lockdown and doesn't have a whole lot else to do could be huge.
Yeah, it could. And I think it's in the context of lockdown that has driven the price up and made it appealing for a terrestrial broadcaster. Without that, in so-called peacetime, and people are hootling off to work, then it would be a different kind of story, I think. But as things stand, Channel 4 have recognised that they might be able to snap up one of the real marquee series here. And it will be glorious if it happens for so many reasons. It will be a nostalgia trip for people of a certain age. We'll be on tenterhooks to see if Lou Bega is retained. We're all crossing our fingers on that. God knows who's going to be presenting it. Obviously, it'll be the Indian commentary feed, but it will still have to be helmed by a handful of people in the UK. There's been rumours that Strauss and Cook have been approached. I don't know if that's true or not. But however this thing is carved up, if it does end up on Channel 4, then it's a significant moment really for the game, coming on the back of the BBC's regenerated interest, if you like, last year and going forward through the 100, and now to see another terrestrial broadcaster being prepared to put a bit of money behind the game. It's a tantalising thing, and just hopefully it does happen. Just one thing, 48 hours, as you say, 48 hours to go until the first ball is bowled, and we still don't know for sure. I mean, I know the BCCI fancies playing this kind of game. It's a power, it's a statement of power and preeminence, isn't it, I suppose. We need them so much more than they need us. And they like to see the little people scrabbling around in the boardrooms to see who might be able to come up with this one. But now, as you say, The Guardian's reporting it. It's almost certainly going to be happening on Channel 4. And that is, it's a reason to be cheerful in these dark and miserable times.
Yeah, amazing news. I wonder if we're not hearing anything. I mean, the reports is that the deal is done, but it's curious that it's not officially been sort of sanctioned. There's been no white smoke. So I wonder if that's because they are scrabbling around with so many people contracted to other things, and, you know, it's not just a case of they send up the old Channel 4 bat signal and everyone gets back together. It's been so long that everyone's either doing other stuff or dearly departed or whatever. So I wonder if they are taking their time to actually see what sort of make up the show will actually look like, whether they'll have to take the feed from India, not do any live commentary and just have a few people in a makeshift studio, whether it's Cook and Strauss. I can't see that. I mean, surely every broadcaster in the country has been sort of following big dogs at Channel 4 on Twitter and stuff and sort of trying to stake their claim. So it will be interesting to see. I wonder if that's why we're not hearing anything, because they're trying to sort their lineup, finalise it before they announce it.
Joe, I think it's quite, Phil touched on it there, that we talk so much, and we have talked so much in this show about the potential of the 100, etc., and what that could do for English cricket, having a bit of high-quality cricket on free-to-air television, and then totally out of the blue, you get a marquee test series going on free-to-air, kind of prime time for a working audience in a way. And just like plucking up some numbers from that Guardian report. So according to the Guardian, Channel 4 attracted a peak of 8.4 million viewers when it last showed Test cricket in 2005. And when they broadcast the World Cup final at the same time as Sky Sports in 2019, That brought in 15.4 million people over the course of the day. And research by the ECB suggested a third of that audience is watching cricket for the first time. And I think for so long, we kind of assume that, you know, young players who've come to the game now, et cetera, were inspired by the 2005 Ashes, et cetera. But young players coming through now actually won't remember the 2005 Ashes, which is quite scary. I mean, how big do you think this potentially could be?
I don't think we should get carried away. What it really needs is people who, because obviously cricket fans are going to tune in anyway. What it needs is people to who aren't cricket fans or casual fans to wake up on day five of a test match and hear that something fantastic is happening and feel like they need to tune in and watch it. I think we're probably stretching expectations if we think that a casual fan or someone who's never watched cricket before is going to think, oh, I'm going to get up at 4:30 in the morning and see what this is all about. So we need the event to back this up in order for it to be a success. But either way, it's a great development. I do wonder if you're a Sky subscriber, obviously you can watch it anyway because it's Channel 4 and it's free, but you might be wondering why you're paying your Sky subscription if you're doing it largely because you're a cricket fan and they're not paying out for the England-India series. That's the sort of odd development. I can't quite get my head around that. Perhaps more news will come out in the coming days. But it's hugely exciting. I'm finding it, there must be a lot of very stressed people at Channel 4 at the moment. I'm finding it quite stressful. I can't, unlike Phil, I can't handle leaving things to the last minute. So
that's a low blow, but an entirely fair one.
So I need those I's dotted and those T's crossed before I can actually relax, even though I have no involvement in the thing whatsoever.
Did you pre-plan that?
Only about 20 seconds ago.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, okay.
No, maybe I'm being a little bit too optimistic, but I do remember being at school during the 2005 Ashes and just remembering, obviously that was an amazing series and that contributed to it as well, but remembering how many people who had previously shown no interest in cricket suddenly cared. I remember at school that I basically had, at that age, I had like one friend who I knew who liked cricket. That was it. And we were the only two people. I remember, yeah, this is an odd story, I guess. So I remember there was a school trip that wasn't that exciting. And then we were walking and then we realised not only we both liked cricket, but we were like complete cricket tragics. So we ended up like picking a combined all-time Surrey 11, like picking your Ken Barringtons, etc. And we were about nine at the time. And anyway, I thought he was the only other person in the school who liked cricket. And then after some holidays and the last couple of tests of the 05 Ashes came out, everyone was really interested. Everyone was playing cricket in the playground, etc. So who knows? You know, Dom Sibley could inspire that in the next generation of cricket lovers. Over the next couple of months.
Cautionary tale, BT Sports took on the Ashes of, 2017-18 with a grand plan to screen a stunning series, an ebbing and flowing stunning series that would bring in the punters and get them to subscribe. Obviously, that was a horror show. That backfired spectacularly on them. And the one concern, I guess, with this deal, is if it does go ahead, is that quite soon it will be unwatchable to all but the most desperate kind of sadists, of which we're four of them. And hopefully it will be a humdinger of a series, but if it's not, it could be quite a long old trudge foot soldiers, you know.
There'll be a hashtag, where is Frasier trending? And it'll be, cricket fans will be getting lynched because of the daily programme of Channel 4 has been put out for, because they've got the whole thing, right? They're doing all the test matches. It's not, well, we don't know the fine details, but they might put it out to other broadcasters as well. Is that right? If it's non-exclusive, so
that's right. But also, the Guardian story, I believe, said that this was including the ODIs and Team 20s as well, which that is potentially, even if the test series ends up 4-0, and we all hope it won't, and actually, I don't think it will now, but we'll come on to that. The ODIs and T20s will hopefully reel some people in and perhaps manage to kind of keep their attention better than a test match if they're kind of introducing themselves to cricket for the first time.
If not, it's a long time to go without your morning fix of Everybody Loves Raymond.
It's suddenly a genius move to have Joss Butler miss the majority of the test series and come back for the one day, isn't it? It's genius by the ECB yet again.
They knew all along, surely. One final thing on this. Phil, is there anything, you know, we're talking about the potential positives of this series being on free-to-air television. Is there anything that can be done to ensure that there's more of this in the future? Or realistically, given the financial call and the games in at the moment, We kind of have to take it if the opportunity arises, but there's not a huge amount that the ECB and governing bodies can actually do.
Well, winter tours is, you know, it's all up for grabs, isn't it? It's just the Wild West. And whoever shoots the quickest and the most and puts the most money behind the bar is going to get the contract. Obviously, the summer stuff is sewn up by Sky's ongoing and fruitful relationship with the ECB. But of course, as we've said already, that relationship is now a more evolved one. And terrestrial TV now has a stake in the game. And that's from what you hear from the BBC, that's an ongoing thing now that will be running for the next few years. That they fully believe in the 100, or rather they fully believed in a new competition. We don't need to get down that rabbit hole again, but certainly they are behind it. And I think behind closed doors, there's an acknowledgement from people at Sky as well, that for all their brilliance, their award-winning brilliance, which is unquestioned, there is that point that you can't get fully inspired by something you can't see. And there is a logical sort of economic benefit from Sky's perspective to allowing some cricket to be shown on terrestrial TV as a kind of showcase, if you like. And so I think people at Sky are very comfortable with a slightly shared content during the English summers from here on in. But as you say, as for the winter stuff, well, it's all up for grabs. And as we've touched on before, competition is maybe good for cricket boards, but it's not necessarily good for punters who are often squeezed for the pennies themselves, and especially in this current economic climate. There's a strong rumour that Amazon are going to be coming into play for the next Ashes next winter. If that happens, then that will be another drain on the purse of the individual. So it's a slightly confused landscape really out there. But let's just take it one step at a time. And there's reasons to be cheerful, I think, going into the next few weeks if Channel 4 do indeed grab the gig. I personally can't wait. I think it'd be stunning.
On to the series itself. Joe, you're hoping for an exciting series. Everyone's hoping for an exciting series. Do you give England a chance? Can you see them winning any tests?
Well, I think I said last week that the series in Sri Lanka, the win in Sri Lanka, the manner of that victory, the way Joe Root is playing has convinced me that England will win a test match. Whether they can win more than one is a stretch. We always have to go back to that stat that India have lost one test at home since England beat them in a series in 2012. So these victories don't happen regularly. But I do think England are capable of winning out there. I would probably guess 3-1, maybe 2-1 if England can hold on for a draw there. I think a series win, I struggle to see it, to be honest. I don't think England have the spinners to beat India in more test matches than India beat England in a four test series.
Jim?
Yeah, similarly sort of pessimistic. I think it would be amazing if England got something out of the series, whether that be a drawn series, or that's probably wishful thinking. But I think if they won a test match and maybe drew a few test matches, that would be a huge achievement. It's all about the batting, isn't it? If England can bat and bat and bat for days and put some pressure on and do that thing where when they bowl, they've got runs on the board, but also they can put pressure on the Indian batsmen in their conditions, then they could get away with something. I think a lot hinges on the Root versus Kohli. Who does the best there? If Root is in his current form that he's shown in Sri Lanka, then potentially he could have a sort of series where he puts himself back in that top four with Smith and Kane Williamson as well and sort of carry a series on his back. I don't know if Root has yet sort of won a series single-handedly, as you might say, people like Flintoff did or Michael Vaughan in the past. So that'd be an interesting thing to look at. But yeah, I mean, my heart says a draw. My head probably says they'll go down 3-1 or something like that.
Phil, if England do leave the series with a respectable result, maybe not a series draw or win, but say 2-1 defeat even, what do you think will be key to them achieving that?
I think there are reasons for them to be cautiously optimistic, and I'm not being blind to this. I mean, I might be speaking utter garbage, of course, but
never.
I'm not letting my heart rule my head. Truth be told, between just us four, you know, I don't massively mind what happens. but looking at it on paper, India, Jadeja's not playing at least for the start of the series and possibly for the whole series. That's a huge miss. straight off the bat. England do not play left-arm spinners very well, and he's the best of the lot. So that's a huge miss. And I know that they will have other options bringing in, and, you know, the left-arm wrist spinner, Kuldeep Yadav, he might get the gig, or maybe it'll be Washington Sundar, who played in the last Test match against Australia, but that was his first-class game in 3 years. So whoever it's going to be is going to be a less potent option than Jadeja. They've got two quicks who aren't going to be playing in the first two Test matches. Mohammad Shami's not playing, and nor is Yadav. So neither of those two pedigree quicks are playing. They obviously have a sensational batting lineup, but there are holes in that first 11. It's not quite as strong a first 11 as they would be putting out under normal circumstances. And then you look from the English side, Joe Root's in the form of his life, the best player of spin in the world, or certainly as good as any player of spin in the world. Stokes is probably the most complete cricketer in the world. They're two gun seamers, albeit that they may and probably will be alternating, and Anderson and Broad are both in form, both bowling well. India have five right-handers in the top six or seven, and Jack Leach is England's best finger spinner. So it will be fascinating to see how he goes. I was tempted to say, and they have in Jos Buttler, a potential game changer, who's finally nailed Test cricket, but not close to being tragic. But unfortunately, he's only been playing one out of the four Test matches. Now, we've touched on that before. We don't need to talk about a game. England are obviously, there's all kinds of issues around their team. You know, the opening pair, who's going to bat three with Bairstow at home, all of these things you've got to throw into the mix. Dan Lawrence is a tyro, who had one good Test match and one poor one in Sri Lanka. So there's loads and loads of holes. And it's hard to make a case that England will go out there and win it, or even that they're going to go out there and draw it. It's hard to make that case. But also, I'm a bit baffled by people lining up and saying, oh, it's going to be 4-0. It's just going to be 4-0. I just don't see that. I just don't see that based on the players that are on the park. A lot of it will hinge on the pitches, but then the curator is saying that he wants to produce a proper cricket wicket. Now, this may end up being a bit of kidology, but the curator of Chennai's pitch and saying he wants to see something in it for the quicks, initially runs on days two and three, and then the spinners that come into play towards the end. When I was out there in 2012, that was say what most of the pitches were like. England won that series. Just want to say one more tiny, tiny thing very, very quickly. I do believe in averages in sport, in the law of averages. And all right. On paper, India are kind of impenetrable at home. But that can't go on forever. It can't go on infinitely that they never lose a Test match at home. And I think now England have got a reasonably good chance of putting up a decent fight here. I really do. In a month's time, you can tell me that I've spoken nonsense.
No, I increasingly am coming to the view that I think England have got a real chance. I said this last week, but in that first test, if England just announced this morning that Ollie Pope is fit for that first test.
Have they?
Yeah, he's in the squad now. And if Stokes is fit enough to bowl, then that's a strong England top seven with lots of bowling options, and as you alluded to. And that India side is, I know they just beat Australia in Australia, and that was one of the greatest series ever, et cetera, et cetera. But it is a reasonably undercooked attack. Ashwin missed the end of that series. Bumrah missed tests there. Ishan missed the whole tour if he plays. So, you know, an undercooked attack against an England batting lineup that, yeah, has its flaws, but has lots of exciting parts to it. I think is reasonably well placed for that first Test match. And then who knows, if England can nick that first Test match, then we could have a real, real good series on our hands. Although I think if England don't win that first Test, I can see it going 3 or 4-0.
As ever, Stokes is so important, and you're right to acknowledge the bowling side of his game. If he is in a condition to bowl 25-30 overs a Test match, then it changes the whole complexion of this team. If they can't guarantee that, then it becomes a squeezed bowling attack. But if Stokes is good to go, and you never quite know, and you never want to overpush him, but if he's good to go, then it opens up that bowling attack. You can play two spinners, you can play the right arm off break bowler and Leach plus two seamers and Stokes. But if Stokes isn't quite there to bowl those kinds of, to get through that amount of work, then it's a different kind of story. But they will be hoping, and apparently from what I've read, he's been going at it hard in the nets, and he looks good and he looks in shape and he's certainly rested. So yeah, I think they have a bit of variety in the bowling attack, and some players in form with the bat.
On reasons to be cheerful, I just want to go back to Jadeja, because I think Phil was absolutely right to point that out as a hugely significant loss for India. And I would equate it, perhaps not in a kind of the same talismanic way as the Stokes, but I think it's a bit like if England didn't have Ben Stokes going into the series in the conditions that India are playing in. A few months ago, last summer, we got Cricviz to do a big study for us on the most valuable test cricketers of the 21st century. And Jadeja came out at number two across the board. Only Muralitharan was more valuable to his team than Jadeja had been to India over the last 20 years. That's largely with the ball, but it's also with the bat, and it's largely in home conditions. So he is a huge loss, and there are obviously decent candidates to replace him, but there is no one of his quality to come in. So I think that really will give England a little bit of a lift heading into that series. The thought of Jadeja at one end and Ashwin at the other, and England struggling is a kind of nightmare situation for England, and probably one we all anticipated. But now without Jadeja there, that kind of opens it up a bit. And obviously India have a brilliant seam attack, but I do think not having that second world-class spinner could make a big difference.
Joe, Bess or Moeen for your second spinner, assuming that Leach is your first. Is Leach your first?
Leach is definitely my first. It's tighter. Ben wrote a good piece on this for wisdom.com, saying really there should be no debate. It should obviously be best based on stats and current form. But actually, Moeen does offer that something that you can't quite describe. You don't know how it's going to go. I would go for Bess just because I don't think you can underestimate how important that Sri Lanka series was. If we just tear up that England side that won 2-0 in Sri Lanka and bring in players who haven't played red ball cricket for a long time, then you do start to wonder how useful that kind of preparation was. So I would go Bess for the first test alongside Leach, with the expectation that Moeen does play a part at some stage later in the series. But it is hard to know when to bring him back in because he's had so little red ball cricket and so little bowling for a long period of time now.
This is the snag, isn't it? Whenever Moeen comes back in, if he is going to play one of these four tests, then he will have to come in cold. There's no other way around it. It's for that reason in part that I'm leaning by the width of a Rizla paper, I'm leaning towards Moeen ahead of Bess, in part because I want him involved in the series somewhere down the line and may as well get him in there now. I mean, it's such a sort of peculiarly lopsided setup at the moment anyway, with Bairstow at home and Butler going back and so on. I would be tempted to get him in, and it's a slightly negative reason, as extra reason, but him at eight versus Bess at eight in a team where last time out, 4 years ago, England kept getting 400 and losing. This time, they've got to get 500 to avoid defeat and then start from there. And so, while Mo is as unpredictable as they come, as we know, with the bat and could stink the place out quite easily, I am leaning towards Mo, in part for that reason, because Moeen at eight, when you're six down, 300 and something on the board, I'd rather him coming out there than Don Bess. But look, It's a tricky one, and it's such a shame that Moeen got ill, isn't it? Because I think he would have featured at least in one of those test matches in Sri Lanka, and then we'd have known a little bit more. Anyway, who knows? It starts in a couple of days. Thank God for that.
I can't remember the set. It's obviously because of the back of the Australia India series and England doing well in Sri Lanka and, you know, more test matches this year than other years and all the COVID stuff. But there's so many sort of issues to pick through and it's so exciting that I can't remember another test series that was built up like this for a long time. So just being devil's advocate, the reason that Sky, you think, haven't bidded for this series is because they're holding out to spend their coin on the Ashes at the end of the year. Do you think that if England would... So let me pose a question. Would you take England beating India in India as over England winning the Ashes in Australia now? Because you look at that India team and they're probably going to have four or five greats of the game. Do you think that, would you take England beating them in India over England winning the Ashes?
No.
No.
I think it would be a better achievement.
Yeah.
But I would rather England win the Ashes just from that sort of kind of pathetic cricket rivalry standpoint more than anything else, really.
Also, caveat, the times we live in, short. Look at how the UCB, look at how the top brass have approached this series as well. A very prominent journalist said to me on WhatsApp, basically England gave up on this series in November when they decided that they would be sending certain people home at certain points in the series. The chances of them sending two of their key players home for, say, the first test match at Brisbane is none. Nil. Null. No chance. No chance. Not a cat in hell's chance. It remains, perhaps pathetically, but it remains absolutely the be-all and end-all in English cricket. And, you know, it shouldn't do. And as Joe says, if you're talking about cricketing achievement, then this is a harder place to go and get a result over a long test series in Australia. Mm. If you're talking about what concerns them, what ticks the boxes, and how they formulate their criteria of success, what English cricket deems to be successful, then it's the two yearly thing against Australia, and it was ever thus, and it will ever be thus.
Incidentally, Joe Root got asked that exact question on Quick Info's polite inquiries, and I thought he was going to kind of just give the diplomatic answer of, oh, they're both really important series, we're winning every game we can. But he said Australia, and we kind of know that's true anyway, but he justified it on a personal basis because he did win in India in his debut series. And
yeah.
He's yet to win in Australia, and he's also had some pretty rough matches in Australia, pretty rough series in Australia. So from Joe, if you ask Joe Root that question, he's pretty emphatic, which is more important.
Yeah, so what do you think?
Well, I think England did win in Australia and then in India in quite a short space of time 10 years ago. I think people talk about 10-11 more, but the 2012 win in India was just much, much bigger achievement. And it required more from England's very best players to win that series. And I think, I mean, teams do beat Australia in Australia. I know England don't very often, but South Africa won there three times this century. India won there twice now in a short space of time. Beating India in India is a greater achievement. I think, quietly, this is one of England. I think this is England's best test side in quite a few years, possibly since that Strauss side or maybe early Cook year side. And I think beating India in India would trump any success in Australia, purely cricketing, even though I think obviously England fans would rather win in Australia.
And that's what makes it so exciting, the fact that it is, there's just a sniff of this being so glorious because it is on free-to-air. India have got a great side. England have got a sort of a really strong side. And, you know, there's a chance that they could do something incredible on Channel 4 at 6 o'clock in the morning.
This has got
Give me
very,
something.
This feels uncomfortably like building into a Football World Cup where for months, no, we don't have a chance. No, we're rubbish. Don't have a midfield. As for the fullbacks, forget the goalkeeper. And now, mere minutes before this thing kicks off,
I was going to say, come next January after the Sydney Test, we might laugh at the idea that we were taking our pick of which series we'd rather win.
Yeah. In my defence, I've been consistently wrong on this one right from the start. But anyway, we should see. Yeah.
Looking at the India squad, the big selection dilemma is essentially who replaces Jadeja for that Jadeja spot. And given various all-round options, they could go one of various ways. So I think their side will be Shubman Gill, Rohit Sharma, Pujara, Kohli, Rahane, Pant, somebody, Ashwin, Bumrah, Siraj, Ishant. The options there are Hardik Pandya, possibly Saha to take the gloves, Akshar Patel to offer left-arm spin option, Washington Sundar played the most recent test, Shardul Thakur, possibly, who did really well in the Brisbane test, or potentially Kuldeep. Joe, which way do you think they will go or should go?
Well, Akshar Patel is the like for like in the sense that you've got the left arm spinner, so that's the way I would go. That being said, I've never seen him bowl a ball with a red ball. He looks a tidy one day spinner. He doesn't look like he's going to tear through England with the red ball, but let's see that happen over the next few days after I've said that now. So that's the way I'd go. Kuldeep Yadav would obviously be the kind of exciting selection and a bit of a risk, but England, after struggling against him in his first ODIs, have played him very comfortably since then. And I obviously a different format, but I think that will be that will be in their minds. And it feels very harsh to drop Washington Sundar after what he did in Australia. But that was a bit of a kind of a freak opportunity. So I would go Axel Pettel, the like-for-like left-arm spinner.
Especially on the back of Ben Baldinha causing such problems and him being there and pretty similar action and all that sort of thing. You'd think that England did look like he was a bit of a bogeyman for them. So, I would go with Joe and go for Axel.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So mine is a series of interviews I did which relates to spin in India and English spinners in India. So I spoke to Ian Salisbury, Monty Panesar, Zafar Ansari and Gareth Batty, who between them cover all but one of England's test tours of India over the last 30 years. I spoke to them about the art of bowling spin in India and the specific challenges involved, but also kind of the overall experience and the pressure of suddenly being expected to perform a completely different match-winning role to that which they perform in England, particularly as they've kind of developed in county cricket where you're lucky to get a few overs. There's plenty of cautionary tales among them, as you'd expect. Ian Salisbury's is kind of the sort of most freakish story, I guess, in that he went out there in 1993 as a net bowler, understudy to Embry and Tufnell. And then a couple of weeks later, he ends up playing as the solitary spinner in the first test in front of 100,000 at Eden Gardens. India picked three spinners, by the way, and Salisbury said, one of us had it right and one of us had it wrong. And as it turned out...
Do you remember who else was in that the seam attack for England? Joe?
Dev Malcolm, yeah. Chris Lewis.
Mark Elam?
No, Elam didn't quite make the tour before his time.
Taylor.
Well done, left arm seamer, Paul Taylor. Up and down, workmanlike, good in English conditions, less so at Eden Gardens, arguably. And Paul Jarvis, back from his latest Rebel tour, you know, but he got the nod for that one.
Stick him in.
Quick through the air. Lovely to come onto the bat, I would imagine, in those kinds of conditions. and then the following test match, Richard Blakey batted at six in that one. Gucci had a bad belly, didn't he? Bad tummy, I think.
Well, I was going to come on to that as well. Not only did Salisbury have the challenges of bowling spin, he also had the challenge of Mike Gatting as their unofficial dietitian. So Gatting's philosophy of eating in India was eat everything you can get your hands on when you first arrive. Get it all in your system, get the bug, then recover, you're good to go. And so as we said, this actually remarkably worked for Gatting, who was just made of kind of cast iron, but did not work so well for his teammates. So Gooch was ruled out for the second test after having a prawn dinner with Gatting the night before. So Salisbury said it was remarkable to see kind of Gatting's eating tour of India.
How has Gatting not had a cookbook release with that sort of mentality? You know, sod the Hemsley sisters or whoever, Joe Witts, get it all in you and get the bug. I mean, that's remarkable.
There was the immortal line from Salisbury of, if you ate with Gat, you got taken down, which England got whitewashed in that series. It's probably worth adding. And then more recently, I spoke to Ansari and Batty, who were kind of the third wheels on the last tour of India in 2016, acting as support spinners to Rashid and Moeen. They each had Ansari played two tests, Batty played one. Even when they played, they got very few opportunities. There weren't really many overs to bowl. Both of them didn't really think they had the faith of Alistair Cook, and both really struggled for rhythm and confidence, which is worth bearing in mind. I don't think we'll get to a point of England considering playing three spinners in India, but it's a story worth calling if they are considering it, because it is just difficult to get spinners enough overs to get the rhythm they need to do what they're expected to do. But perhaps the most interesting of the interviews was Monty, who had three tours out there, 2006, 2008, 2012, when he kind of famously, alongside Swan, bowled England to victory in that series. Yeah, it's worth remembering Monty he obviously took Sachin for his first test wicket in 2006, but really struggled on the rest of that tour and 2008. Monty's one of the most skillful bowlers, spin bowlers England had ever produced. And it took him three tours to figure out really how to bowl well in India. And he said so himself. He said the wickets got a bit faster, he thought, due to the IPL, and balls had a harder seam in his third tour, which meant it was a bit easier to get perches for a bit longer. And he was obviously a completely different bowler and bowled beautifully in that series, really outperformed Swan, came in after the first test defeat and England were unbeaten thereafter. But it just made me think it's worth bearing in mind when we see Bess and Leach bowling over the next few weeks that it took Monty three tours to get there. And these guys haven't had much cricket for a long time. And we want them to do well. And they're the best spinners alongside Moen that England have. But we've got to be patient with them, I think.
Next up, we're going to play a section of an interview that Joe conducted with Owen Morgan that was part of the most recent issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. It was part of a special feature on the English game's biggest disruptors of the 21st century. Joe, it's a very interesting interview. And before we play it, what gripped you most in that chat with Morgan?
The thing I liked about it was that he immediately grabbed hold of the theme. He knew exactly why I was speaking to him, that he appreciated he was a disruptor. I would say, I mean, listeners can make up their own minds. I think he's quite proud of his disruptor role in English cricket, that he's shaken things up where he's felt necessary. I think that, I don't know if you're going to play this bit, but him talking about the IPL, I found particularly interesting. He alongside Peterson, was very much an early cheerleader for it at a time when English players who went out there were generally kind of disregarded as greedy, and there was no appreciation for the development of a game that might happen by playing in the IPL. And he's not afraid to point that out. He's proud that he was saying, well, before other people, that the IPL could be a great thing for English cricket. And I think most people, not all, but most would agree that has been the case. Played a significant role in England winning the World Cup, I would argue. And the development of some players like Archer, like Butler, in turning them to the England players that we see today.
Mm. I thought what was most interesting in the IPL chat was the detail about how he wasn't actually making money from his first IPL. And that's something I've heard. I think Luke Wright said that on the T20 pod he did with us in the summer.
Sam Billings as well.
Yeah, so these guys who went out onto the early editions of the IPL weren't actually making money. They were going, obviously there would be financial opportunities down the line if they did well there, but it was predominantly for the improvement of their games. Anyway, it is a really interesting conversation, and here it is.
On your own disruption, as it were, right from the start of your career, you stood out as someone who thinks a bit differently, or at least does things their own way. Is that kind of reflective of your personality more generally, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. And I wouldn't say it's always differently. It's always sort of, my point of view, I think, is always different. And I see it as normal and logical. And there's thought and process behind everything that I do. And it's not necessarily, you know, going with a group's decision or going with the way everybody plays because that's what people do. It's because, you know, I see it as being the right decision. And I've sort of always been like that since I was a kid and came across to London at 16, so in Middlesex. I've always sort of done things the way that I think is right, or I've been taught to do them. So sort of, it's been something, yeah, I suppose.
Is that family influence? Is that, are your parents strong on that kind of stuff?
I think one of my biggest characteristics is that I have always shown belief in my own ability from start to finish, regardless of how bad the form I'm in,
right,
or how dry, or I've always had that belief that I can get out of it. And I think that's a similar attribute in believing that your own game or your own decision is good enough to get you out of a hole or to achieve something or get you over the line.
Mm.
Probably contributes to it a little bit.
Being an Irishman who wanted to play for England, it could be considered disruptive in itself at that point. but you were pretty single-minded in that ambition from very early on in your career, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, yeah. From, I think I was about 13, maybe 14, when we sat down with the Irish coach at the time, me and my dad, because I'd spoken to my dad about wanting to play Test cricket and wanting to play professionally and doing all the above, and Dad was like, well, you can't do that here, like, we need to look at other avenues. And I think it was a few weeks later he said, we're going to watch a club game down the road, and the Irish coach is going to be there, we're going to have a chat with him. My dad spoke on behalf of both of us and just said, Owen said he wants to play Test match cricket and would like to go to England if the opportunity ever came about. Not only that, would love to play for England. So yeah, it's a bit foolhardy or stupid or courageous or brash.
Did you ever have any concerns about being accepted as an England player, or was that always clear that that would be determined by your performance, though, kind of in your hands to an extent.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely in my hands. I think, you know, playing cricket in Ireland was a challenge within itself, because when the age I am growing up, it certainly wasn't many troubles around, but it was certainly viewed as a British sport or an English sport, and it was looked down upon if you participated or played in it. So I didn't really ever feel like I fitted in playing football, Gaelic football, hurling. I really enjoyed them playing, but in the back of my head I'm thinking, oh, all I want to do is play cricket. And then sort of coming across to Middlesex, that feeling of, oh, I'm living my dream, I don't really care what anybody else thinks. I never really, I suppose, gave much thought to trying to fit in. I suppose I just thought, you know what, if I do well, I'll enjoy this.
The way you batted too was very different. It perhaps doesn't seem so different now, because lots of people are playing unorthodox shots, but were you always determined to kind of embrace that otherness? Did you see it as a selling point, or was that just kind of how it came naturally to you?
No. Well, the reason I started playing all these inventive shots, sort of the stuff that's normal now, was to start with. So in order to get into the T20 team, everybody was talking about, you got to clear the ropes and you got to pick your gaps. And I could pick gaps, but the gaps that I picked were different.
Right.
And I couldn't clear the ropes. I remember playing first season of T20 cricket, I think it was about 18 or 19 at Middlesex, and I was caught in front of the pavilion about three times, and I was like, I'm just going to have to find another way here to try. And I'd already played the sweeps and the laps, but obviously there's a higher risk in getting out at the judgment of what people would say, what your coach would think of it. But luckily I came in and they worked, so I just sort of stuck with them until I developed a bit more of a power game.
And then a bit later on, you were talking up the IPL long before it was fashionable in English cricket, at a time when the ECB were nowhere near as keen on it as they are now. You obviously felt... Yeah, I mean, that's probably an understatement. But you clearly felt that was a cause worth fighting for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, going there and experiencing it for the first time as a young 20-year-old was just the best thing ever. I played, I think the first season I played about five out of the first six games, and then didn't play a game for the rest of the season, but got to play with Steyn, Callis, Cumbley, Boucher, Peterson, Dravid, like rubbing shoulders with these guys, and, you know, just sitting back and watching and trying to take everything in was just the best thing ever. And for me, the most I learned in a short space of time has always been going to the IPL and you know, watching different guys or focusing on different things or working on something that you didn't think of, or going there and being reassured about what you're doing is the right thing. You just need to persist with it, because it is the best tournament in the world. So right from the first time that I went, I was like, how is everybody not seeing this? This is just unbelievable. This is the future. So...
Was it frustrating then to see it kind of, it was almost characterised as those players who went there were greedy rather than going there to advance their game? That wasn't really talked about at that point.
No, but the other thing nobody talks about is I think the first year I went there, it actually cost me money to go, because the implications in our contracts with our counties were so drastic, and I wasn't being paid on a big contract in Middlesex or anything, but the implications were so drastic, and I wasn't on a lot of money at Bangalore, that I didn't make any money going.
Right.
And when you seem to say that to people, they don't believe it. They think, oh, this lad's a bit of a fool and he's trying to pull the wool over our eyes. But there are a few guys that have been in the same boat before. And I think just the whole developmental thing, it's sort of in the back of my head, the longer term picture was, if I always came back a better player, I would always push to play for England. That's just, you know, that's how I saw it.
Did you ever consider it could do the opposite, damage your England career by kind of swimming against the tide like that? We obviously saw with Kevin Peterson, it became a source of conflict with the ECB.
Yeah, absolutely. I ran the risk of that, particularly in my Test career. I was advised to come back and play county cricket and you know, fight my way back in through that avenue. But the way that I actually got selected to play test match cricket was through international performances and other performances in a white ball shirt. I mean, I only had one full county season, and that was when I was 20. It was 22 or something, and average mid-40s, but I got 100 against South Africa. That was more like a one-day 100 than a four-day 100.
Yeah.
So I always thought that, you know, if I build my white ball game, that will always impact my red ball game, and I could come back and play championship cricket, but I'm in amongst, you know, a couple of hundred people trying to get one position. And you're playing on wickets that aren't susceptible to scoring runs in April and May.
More recently, the kind of most obvious example, I guess, of your disruption is the transformation of England's one-day sides under your leadership. How do you think you were able to spark such a dramatic change in such a short space of time?
I think, you know, certainly I had my own ideas about how the team should play and the way in which we wanted to go about things, but none of that would have been possible without Strousey allowing myself, Trevor Bayliss and Paul Farbrace the freedom to play around with exactly what we wanted to achieve with that. I suppose their style of play was the most important thing. Selection was extremely important, so channeling everybody onto the same page to achieve the same thing with 2019 in mind helped myself, TB and Farby like a huge amount, because there's always a continuous message and it never changed throughout the whole 4 years, but that was allowed to be able to be consistent and transparent by the selectors being on the same page, Strousey being on the same page, and then all the senior players knowing exactly the direction we're going in and being able to drive that.
Do you think, in a sense, how bad England were at the 2015 World Cup may have actually helped in that sense, and that there was no disputing that significant change was needed?
Absolutely. If we had limped our way into the quarterfinal, or maybe even fluked to a semi-final, there's no way there would have been drastic measures taken. I don't think Strad's job would have been, job as MD would have been given to Strousey. I think Paul Downton would have been kept on, and I don't think a lot would have changed.
And in the World Cup itself, 2019, people might not necessarily admit it now, but Jofra Archer's arrival just before the World Cup wasn't necessarily well received by a few people. There was a school of thought that he could disrupt the team dynamic. I wondered, how had you had in your mind for a while that Archer would be part of your World Cup plans, and did you have any doubts at all about adding him to the group at that stage?
Everybody had their eye on Joff. I mean, certainly having played against him quite a bit for Middlesex, you earmark him as a guy that could definitely play international cricket, just obviously depending on how long his qualification would take and how his body would hold up to county cricket, were two challenges that he would have had to overcome. But certainly I didn't have any doubt when it came around to adding him to, I suppose, a preliminary squad to start with, and then seeing how he was around the group, did he engage, what the reaction was to everybody else, and I suppose the continuous question we asked ourselves was, are guys adding value? So Jofra certainly did.
And then immediately after the World Cup final, you famously said you'd asked Adil Rashid if Allah was with you, and he'd confirmed that he was, and you've since said that multiculturalism has made you stronger as a team. Do you feel like it's especially important to emphasise that point in the current climate, that this England cricket team should stand for something positive and inclusive?
Absolutely. I think we are the best sporting team in the country to embody diversity, change, and making things functional and productive in that way to make a difference, because we live and breathe it every day of when we're together as a side or when we play. And I actually think we need to start talking about it a little bit more, because it has become such an important part of, I suppose, society this year. You know, everybody sort of sat down at the start of the year and, or mid-year and sort of was forced to look at where their moral compass is pointing. And you know, I think within our side, we take it for granted that we get on really well. And there's quite a lot of diversity within the group, and how we make it happen. So I think from here, we need to start telling individual stories a bit more and being more vocal about how we sort of are as a group and embrace everybody's culture and, you know, just raising awareness around education and different, I suppose, variants in society.
And then just finally, more generally, do you think English cricket is a more inclusive and progressive place than it was when you first came into it?
100%. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I do. I think certainly this year there has been some extremely progressive work initiated by Tom Harrison. I think at the start of the summer, when we sort of all came back, the way he spoke about English cricket's history and how we had gotten things wrong to a certain extent, but really, really want to get it right. And then the people he engaged with, the communities, and the planning that's going behind the future programs, particularly at grassroots level, have been impressive.
Away from England, the biggest news of the week was the postponement of Australia's tour of South Africa. In a statement, Cricket Australia's interim CEO, Nick Hockley, said, due to the public health situation in South Africa, which includes a second wave and new variant of the virus, and following extensive due diligence with medical experts, it has become clear that travelling from Australia to South Africa at this current time poses an unacceptable level of health and safety risk to our players, support staff and community. Cricket South Africa issued a strongly worded statement of their own. Graham Smith said, we are extremely disappointed by the decision of Cricket Australia. Cricket South Africa has been working tirelessly in recent weeks to ensure that we meet every single expectation of Cricket Australia. If that series is not rescheduled, which looks unlikely, it means that New Zealand have qualified for the World Test Championship final. And I think finally, it's worth saying that the COVID-19 situation in South Africa is very similar, in fact, almost identical as it was to when England pulled out of the tour there in late 2020. It was actually much worse when Sri Lanka toured there at the turn of the year. Phil, what do you make of that?
My first thought is for South African cricket, which has been, beaten from pillar to post over the last couple of years. Mass defections to English cricket. Let's charitably put it, mismanagement from the board, which has been rejigged in recent months. And when England pulled out just before Christmas, as you mentioned, that involved a huge financial hit for Cricket South Africa. And now this will have a similar impact on their already very squeezed finances. So my heart goes out to Cricket South Africa, and for the players involved as well. This would have been a chance for them to re-emphasise their place in world cricket after a rough couple of years, really. And they're an extremely proud cricketing nation as well. And they'd have been looking forward to receiving Australia, I think. So it's a real blow from an administrative perspective, for the fans as well. They've been robbed of what would have been a really, really good series. Only Australian setup will truly know what the motivation is. But from the outside, it's hard to argue with caution being the name of the game, is it? It's hard, really, in these circumstances, these extraordinary times and all of that. It's hard to argue with a decision such as this. It was hard to argue with England coming home when they were faced with what they had just before Christmas time. All right, let's take it back to last summer. If either of the West Indies or Pakistan had turned around and said, you know what, we want to play cricket, but we don't want to risk our squads in England in the height of this horror show, then I don't think any England cricket fan really would have queued up and said, well, hold on, you have an obligation to come over here and you're actually disrespecting us or disrespecting the game by not showing up. So I think my instinctive thought on this, and I have to say I haven't read around it too much and I haven't read the quotes. I was interested by Smith's, as you say, strongly worded response. I would have imagined, at least diplomatically, it would have been a bit more mollifying from South Africa's perspective. But it speaks, I suppose, of a cricketing culture that is scrabbling around at the moment. But yeah, I wouldn't want to queue up and question Australia's decision here or bring any kind of suggestion of skullduggery into play at this point. Because, well, I mean, the evidence is staring us all in the face.
I saw Smith's interviews on social media, some of it, and it seemed to me like he was more annoyed that it had sort of maybe been a late call and that a lot of work had gone into getting it on and working on some of those things that England had concerns about before Christmas and that sort of thing. So it seemed like, although you can't have any qualms with Australia pulling out because of the safety and things like that, that maybe they were a bit irked that they got this far down the line and it looked like it was happening and then they pulled out relatively late. But I mean, yeah, you can't have any issue with it really.
Yeah, I'm just going to, I read a piece by Telf Advice on Crick Buzz, who pointed out that less than 24 hours earlier, the South African president had announced the daily number of new cases of the virus had eased enough to suspend the ban on the sale of alcohol and public access to beaches. That's the quote from Telford's piece. And he said there were just over 2,500 new cases in South Africa on Monday compared to almost 22,000 just under a month ago. So this is an improving situation there. Albeit there is the complication of the variant, which is obviously the cause for anxiety kind of across the world. I just wondered, did England cutting short their white ball tour of South Africa kind of add to cricket Australia's anxiety and kind of set a precedent for this, almost make it acceptable? And I certainly wouldn't question any Australian individual who didn't want to go there. But I mean, Australia did tour England in September. We weren't in lockdown as such, but we did have strict measures, and the cases in England at that time were about the same as they are in South Africa at this point. And it does kind of reinforce this notion that the big three are committed to playing each other, but the other series are much more expendable. Now, maybe that's being harsh on Cricket Australia in this case. The situation isn't directly comparable to what Australia experienced in England in September, but it is unfortunate that it's just another example of adding to that sense that it's kind of one rule for one and another rule for another.
It does impact the World Test Championship. So if the series is not rescheduled, New Zealand will qualify. And now listen closely, listeners, if you want to hear all the permutations. So Australia will qualify if England beat India 1-0, 2-0 or 2-1, or if India beat England 1-0, or if the series ends in a draw. England can only qualify if they beat India 3-1, 3-0 or 4-0. And India will qualify if they beat England 2-0, 2-1, 3-0, 3-1 or 4-0.
You say that, yes. I was reading Ben's piece where he obviously gets fair. This is Ben's favourite part of cricket, basically, the math side of it. And he said he was talking about slow over rates could be crucial here.
So I think they already have been.
They already have been, but they could be again. So basically, captains need to watch out on their slow over rates during the series, because that could change the situation again because things are so tight. So Ben is going to be sitting there with his watch, checking these overrates over the course of the next few weeks on the edge of his seat.
A few Benny Hill type sessions as it gets more more down to the wire.
Yeah, that is totally mad. That's how that competition could be decided.
It does just show that, I mean, Australia have effectively taken it out of their own hands by not going to South Africa. So it shows how concerned they must have been to effectively relinquish the opportunity to make that World Test Championship final and have the sort of the ball be in their court and they be in control of it. So the fact that they've decided not to do that probably does speak volumes as well.
There has been some test cricket this week. So right now, Bangladesh are 242 for 5 at the end of the first day of their first test at home for the West Indies. We had a really good test in Pakistan. Phil, you watched a fair bit of this test that Pakistan won by 7 wickets after being 27 for 4. Fahad Alam scored his third test 100, and 34-year-old left-arm spinner Norman Ali took 5 for 35. Phil, what did you enjoy most from it?
It was a good kind of slow-moving humdinger of a test match. Ebbed and flowed. After that first day, South Africa would have thought, all right, we're right in here. I mean, I think one of the four wickets was a night watchman, but even so, 30 for four overnight. And, you know, I mean, Pakistan is my second team always, just because of the way they go about their business. So I was a bit down on it after that, and then flipped on the following day, and Farwood Alam was doing his unique and strangely beautiful thing. But one of the great cricket photographs I've ever seen has emerged from this test match with Ngidi, I think it was Ngidi, bowling right arm round at the top of his mark, just getting going. And the photographer has positioned himself right behind Farwood Alam, who's standing about 7 yards outside his leg stump. Chest open, obviously, completely open stance, with the bat sort of floating in the wind somewhere. And this is a man who's got a test match 100, and a very, very good back to the wall test match 100 as well.
It's like how I bat in the nets when there's a fast bowler. You just, you know, sort of get your body well out of that way.
It looks like that, doesn't it? It looks like a complete kind of rebuttal of any kind of approach to the game, and yet the lad can play and averages 50 odd in first class cricket.
So Shubman Gill does it too. He sort of backs away and it looks almost like he's backing away out of fear or whatever, but then he sort of carves it through. So yeah, maybe we'll see more of it.
Yeah, no, I have seen that. He's a slightly more classical player, but
true,
I know
true,
just I know where you're coming from. And I also like to see Markram get runs, who I think is a really good player, who's inexplicably not quite cracked top level cricket yet. He had a very good year actually in Test cricket. I think he made sort of 400s in a year, but then he's fallen away. Inexplicably not worked in one day cricket, and yet you'd look at him and you think he'd be a very useful one day opener or number three. So it's good to see him get runs. And if I were going to pick a moment from the game, it was that last half an hour on day three, when it looked like Pakistan were knackered and there'd been a long, fruitless day in the dirt. And then Yasir Shah came in and he's a lone man, isn't he? He's a lone leggy in Test cricket now, all right? Rashid Khan gets the odd game here and there, but essentially, he's of the big nations, he's the last man standing, really. And so to see him affect another game of cricket, another Test match, was quite heartening, really. It was good to see. And Babar Azam gets a win under his belt as skipper. So yeah, it was good. It was a really good quality game of cricket, I found. And the next one starts tomorrow morning, I think. It's Thursday morning.
Two really evenly matched sides, I think. I don't think there are many teams in Test cricket who are that evenly matched, I think. You're right to pick out that mini passenger play at the end of day three. I loved how close Abid Ali was at Silly Point, just seeing the right-handers dead bat it, but he was still in with a chance of catching them. I thought he bowled beautifully, and a wonderful test. And yeah, I mean, I wish this series was longer, really do, especially with it being on Sky and being able to watch it in the UK. Wish there was more of it.
Just one thing to add, Quinton de Kock, I've never seen a captain look less enamoured to have the armband as Quinton de Kock does. He has that look on his face of being slightly startled anyway, but he's clearly not the right man for the job, right? You know, he's a sort of untrammelled, flair batsman keeper who needs to go out there and not worry about it. And he's famously kind of interested in fishing and hunting. And, you know, he's not a particularly cerebral kind of bloke, I don't think. And yet he's got the gig, probably because he's one of the first names on the team sheet and Faf doesn't want to do it anymore.
It's a bit Joe Root getting the captaincy in early 2017, isn't it? I know they're different characters, but it kind of similar to those, like, just who else was there? There are so few people in that South Africa team who are actually guaranteed of a spot in the 11. I know, you know, Markram's doing well now. He's scored millions of runs in first-class cricket this year, by the way. But he's not been assured of his place. Temba Voom has not been assured of his place. Wassey van der Dusen's not really assured of his place. So there wasn't really that many. There weren't really many other options.
And I think Markram is, provided he can score enough runs, I think he's the long-term option. He was captain of their under-19s team. He's a very articulate bloke. He's very mature for his age. I think he will be their plan, but he's got to score enough runs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it clearly was their plan. They gave him the ODI captaincy for a bit after like 5 minutes of international cricket. So I think they've been thinking that way for quite a long time. So yeah, interesting to see how that develops. Elsewhere, South Africa women are currently 2-0 up against Pakistan in the T20 between the two sides. Tasmin Brits has scored half centuries in both games so far, while Shabnin Ismail continued a fine form from the ODI series with figures of 5 for 12 in the second game. Jim, what's your moment of the week?
I think it does still count as this week. It is it called Toasty Sandwich Gate? Everything's a gate nowadays, but yeah, Toasted Sandwich Gate. So this is a report in the Sydney Morning Herald, which the reporter suggested that there was trouble in the Australian camp and that players were a bit peeved with Justin Langer, and they hadn't been, they'd sort of been going behind his back and reporting to the coach, the other coaches, and they were a bit annoyed with his management style, his intensity that we've seen in the test documentary that was on Amazon last year. And there's lots of interesting things that came out of it, but one thing that everyone sort of latched onto was this quote that Langer told off an unnamed player for carrying a toasted sandwich onto the field. I'm not sure if he was carrying on it or was it already in his pocket, but he told him off for it because he said, "Oh, you know, it looks bad. How does it look? We're trying to save a game at the Gabba, and you're walking on with a snack, basically." So then, obviously, cricket Twitter. You know, there's lots of puns and lots of. Emmental disintegration was a good one that I saw, and there's a few other ones, but there was sort of a clamour to find out who it was, and it was obviously Marnus Labuschagne. It was always going to be him. The only thing that I was sort of querying was what was in it. Apparently it was cheese and ham, whereas he strikes me as definitely like a peanut butter and jelly kind of guy. So
has it been confirmed yet? I thought it was that there was an interview very recently.
No, it has been confirmed.
I was doing my swatting up, Liaz, as you told me to, and Langer has come out and said, yeah, does it make him a bad guy for bollocking Marnus for carrying on a so it was him. It was always going to be him. And other people have weighed in. Shane Warne, famous toasty lover, had a Breville installed at Hampshire, I think, didn't he, Warne? But he's weighed in and said, you can only do that shit when you're winning. So it's fine if you're winning, but if you're losing, no toasties and no snacks.
The classic skewed morality of high-end cricket yet again. I totally defend Langer on this. You can't walk on the pitch with a toasted sandwich in your pocket. It's totally ridiculous. If you did that Saturday threes, then you'd be turfed out. You can't do that. You simply can't do it. It's totally ridiculous. I'm fully behind Langer on this in calling him out.
I've taken sweets. You must have taken the odd sweet or something into the field in your pocket. That's different,
yeah,
right?
Sure. Yeah. But there are limits. You know, you don't take a roast dinner onto the pitch, do you?
I'd like to see it
in one pocket and Brussels in the other. You don't take a cooked meal onto the pitch.
Is it the toasting that's perturbing you?
It's the bread-based element to it. It's the substantial food stuff nature of it. But yeah, toasting it is just pushing it one step too far, I think.
Yeah.
It's very, very strange behaviour.
It reminded me of going back to your school days when you didn't have shin pads and you would shove exercise books down your socks in case you got the. I wondered if it was maybe because, you know, he was fielding at short leg and he couldn't find his equipment, so he was just sort of stuffing some sandwiches down there from the tea interval, but I don't think that was the case.
Yeah,
he's just basically
exercise books in place of shin pads, did you, James, when you were growing up?
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, when I were a lad. Yeah. We were lucky to have exercise books.
I'm with Phil on this one. I think Langer's response has been remarkably mild mannered. Like,
yeah.
Imagine you played 100 tests for Australia, you know, you were part of that Australia side and you're going down 2-1 at home to depleted India side and your second best batsman's going out with a toasty.
By Warne's logic, you know, if you've won 16 test matches in a row, what can you take onto the pitch, I wonder?
A whole banquet.
Just mowing.
I like your idea of a carvery, sort of gravy in the box, you know, different trimmings placed around your body. That would be quite a good one. Yeah,
that's straight mid wicket, just position it there. But 5 runs if you hit it, but, you know, the pros outweigh the cons.
I think the reason I chose it as a moment is obviously it's quite funny, but also the serious thing is that perhaps it points to there being trouble at Mill in the Australia camp, and the fact that some, I think the report says it's senior players have gone to the press effectively to sort of leak this stuff about Langer, rather than Langer in his interview this morning when he outed Labuschagne, and he also sort of said that he was disappointed that they didn't come to him first and talk about it, sort of airing their dirty laundry in public, or airing their greasy toasties in public. But
nice.
So it does that. Thanks. It does suggest that things aren't. I know they've had a long time in the bubble and things like that. But it suggests that after that defeat, you know, they perhaps need a bit of time to lick their wounds.
Yeah, it happens with cricket teams, doesn't it? It happened with Andy Flower's England team. Eventually, that kind of intensity becomes corrosive, or can become corrosive. I'm not saying it's necessarily happened here, but as ever with Australian cricket, if they lose a few Test matches at home, then things start to come out. And you're right to bring this up, Jim, because it does tap into something about their setup. And was it Usman Khawaja, Joe? Was it on the documentary last year who called this out and was quite articulate actually about Langer's how his enthusiasm can actually become quite claustrophobic,
and the players
seeing elements of that.
Yeah, and then players were kind of intimidated by him, didn't want to go and actually kind of have a proper conversation. And I think it's interesting about Flower, because I think that's an interesting example. Is that kind of style of coach, that real hands-on, and like Peter Moores was a similar example, different kind of personality, but always being there rather than being a sounding board when you need them. I think it seems increasingly like kind of an outdated style of coaching. It's obviously very different to the Bayliss Silverwood style that we see with England. And perhaps that's what players prefer these days. And particularly when you have potentially several coaches, if you're playing at the IPL or other T20 leagues, do you want that kind of one man overbearing coach who kind of tells you exactly how to do things? Now, Langer has come out and said that's not his style of coaching at all. But between the documentary, this is the problem when you do a documentary. Yeah. They're great to watch, but it does leave you open to criticism. He does looks at times like a bit of a pain to work under.
Mm. I think it's worth mentioning as well, probably should have mentioned it earlier, that one of the consequences of the postponed Safford tour is that Australia only have one scheduled test before the Ashes, and England have 11. So they don't actually have that much time in cricketing time together, really, to get things right if things have gone slightly awry.
He said we're fresh, though. We'll be knackers.
Phil, your moment of the week.
My moment of the week was James Vince, the great enigma that is James Vince, playing an iridescently beautiful innings in the Big Bash eliminator or playoff or something or other. Anyway, there was something on the game, and he came out and strummed a stunning 90-odd, 98 not out he ended up with in the end, chasing 160-odd, and he made a mockery of the attack that he was facing. Under lights, was given all the props by the big Australian beast in the commentary box from punter downwards. They were winning the game so comfortably, his Sydney team, that they actually, his opposite number, his non-striker, actually deliberately slowed down in order to try and get James Vince to his 100. They had three overs in which to get a handful of runs. Vince faced the first ball of I think the 17th or 18th over and clothed it straight to extra cover and took a single to take himself to 98. Thereafter, his man blocked out the rest of the over. The crowd were loving it, incidentally, and were willing him on. But Vince being Vince, of course, he gets down to the other end and he needs two for his 100. He has to hit a boundary because scores are level. And Andrew Tye runs in, bowls a particularly short pitcher that sort of floats over Vince's head and shoulder, unhittable, bounces through three or four times to the keeper for a wide. Sydney win the game. Vince is left high and dry on 98. The crowd are booing, but they're kind of laughing as well. It seems like kind of one of these sort of cricketing moments where, you know, you might give them half a look, but then you shake hands and get on with it. Vince threw daggers at Andrew Tye and then gave an interesting passive-aggressive interview afterwards when asked, what do you think about Tye's final delivery? He says, well, you'll have to ask him. It landed by his bootlaces, so you tell me. Which I thought was slightly ungracious, to be honest. Because he's just come and made people's night and batted beautifully, and you can understand why he's going to want that 100. Of course you do, but he's got his team into the next part of this tremendously elongated and never-ending tournament. And I just thought, be the bigger man here, Jimmy boy. Be the bigger man. Just stroll off 98. It's kind of cooler to get 98 than 100 anyway. But no, he was seething in his own kind of slightly inverted and introverted way. But yeah, it was just a classic Vince moment, really. And it reminded me of another doomed stylist, Ian Bell, who, do you remember when he got 199 at Lords and then caught and bowled by Paul Harris against South Africa and walked off sort of swearing into his helmet, as he always used to, into his helmet strap. And Duncan Fletcher then put the boot in after the game. He said, how can you do that on 199? Just knock it down to long on for a single. He charmed the pants of everyone for 199 and was still the villain, was still the kind of the weak-willed, lily-livered, hopeless aesthete. And I'm afraid our boy James just slips effortlessly into that category yet again, despite having completely ruled the innings and the evening. It's a very James Vince moment. On, I think, tomorrow morning.
In fairness, I don't think that had anything. This didn't have anything to do with Vince himself. On the Big Bash.
It wouldn't have happened to anyone else. It wouldn't have happened. It had to happen to Vince. He had to cloth his chance to hit a boundary when he was on 97 and then receive that delivery when he was on 98. It had to happen to Vince.
I've been off for the last week, so I haven't been following the cricket as closely as usual. So I was quite surprised to see, looking at the Big Bash scores, like Marnus Labuschagne turning into Rashid Khan. Like, I know he can bowl a bit of leg spin, but yeah, that was quite interesting. That was not my moment of the week, though. My moment of the week was from the Abu Dhabi T10. I don't know if you've seen this, but...
No.
The lad who was changing his shirt.
Yeah. Luke Wright was captaining this side. Jamie Overton bowled a rank full toss outside off stump, going hurtling towards a boundary. And UAE's Ronnie Mustafa was changing his shirt. So his shirt was basically off whilst he was chasing the ball. And if I'm picking a specific moment, it's Luke Wright's confused face watching this.
Good quiz name.
So that was my moment of the week.
I've watched very little of the T10 thing, seen one or two brief moments. It does amuse me how people are kind of... The mental gymnastics required to try and really get behind T10, but also put the boot in on the 100. And there's been quite a few of these voices on Twitter. It does amuse me. More of the 10-over stuff, but definitely not the 100-ball stuff. I don't know. We'll get there in the end.
Nicholas Pooran's doing quite well. I think he scored like 89 off 20-odd balls.
How long does it go on for?
I don't know.
Just go straight into the IPL. No one knows.
And that is the end of today's show. Cheers, guys. Listeners, if you enjoyed it, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week after the first test between England and India in Chennai. Cheers.